I bring you greetings from my colleagues and students at Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a great privilege for me to be here with you today. And I'm very glad of it because this is reminding me of home. I've only taught at Virginia for about 7 years, but for 19 years before that, I was a parish rector, and for 10 years was rector of a parish in Greenwich Village, very much like this one, I have to say. It's lovely to be here. And in fact, I want to say a little bit about why I miss it so much, is that around this time of year, every year, at St. Luke's in Greenwich Village, at least 20 adults would have come forward to prepare themselves for baptism or confirmation or reception or the reaffirmation of the baptismal promises. It was always a big event at St. Luke's, 20 people with 20 sponsors. It was a big deal. And we put them through a lot of things, including something. We always took them on a silent retreat for 2 nights and 3 days at a local monastery. Of all the things we had them do for New Yorkers, to be together and shut up for 3 days was the greatest challenge they had as they began to prepare for baptism. We took them 1 year to a convent near Morristown, New Jersey, run by an Episcopal order of nuns, the Sisters of St. John the Baptist, who for many years actually taught at our parish school. 100 years ago, they built this extraordinary convent. It looks like a French chateau. There's room for 100 nuns, and across the way was a school that they built, which was now the retreat center. Rolling hills all around. It's a very, very beautiful place, but by the time we got there, there were only 4 nuns left in that, sort of banging around in that huge, huge chateau. So it really was quiet. And just down the road from the convent, was this amazing old-style conventual cemetery that looked like a chapel without walls. There was actually a kind of, it was shaped like a chapel, no walls, no roof, but you knew you were in a holy space. And the nave of this outdoor cemetery chapel was bisected by a kind of alley marked out in hedgerows. And the alley led to this beautiful old crucifix, very large crucifix that sort of loomed over the place, very weathered, obviously had been there for a very long time. And on either side was a plinth that was empty, and that we assume maybe 75 years ago had been a statue of Mary on one side, a statue of John on the other side. So you had to sort of imagine the beauty that once had been there. And that crucifix presides over very neatly spaced rows of little white stone crosses, each one marking the grave of a sister who had died. And then, as if they were imitating the architecture of their own conventual chapel, where the nuns would be cloistered on one side of the rood screen and the sort of unwashed lay people would be on the other side. So it was in this cemetery that outside this enclosure, that was not really an enclosure, there were 30 more graves, neatly lined up, equally spaced, identical crosses. And it turns out those were for the family members of the sisters who had died, or for their friends, or for associates of the order. I mean, that convent and its graveyard, if you can imagine it today, in all of its solitude and in its decayed beauty, provided an extraordinary venue for the adults in our parish who were assembling themselves to prepare themselves for baptism. It was a place of safety, of quiet, of security. As T.S. Eliot might have put it, that this was a place where they knew that prayer had been valid. But there was also something unsettling about the place. The convent grounds were sort of in a sort of small valley, surrounded by an ancient forest. I mean, about as ancient as you can get in northern New Jersey, but it was old enough. And in late winter, when we went there, when everything still was bare and the wind was right, those trees that surrounded the cemetery gave off an uncanny noise, a kind of windy sighing, a steady and haunting undercurrent of unarticulated sound. And when the wind picked up a little, as it tended to do in that season of the year, the sighing intensified in ways that sort of startled you, just took you by surprise. Somehow the placement of the trees had amplified the sound in that little valley, and it created a kind of roar that seemed wildly disproportionate to the relatively mild breeze you could feel, or to just the slight bending of the trees that you could see. In a place that was so rooted in tradition, a landscape that was so lovingly shaped and manicured, the roar of the trees unseated your tranquility, troubled the complacent silence, made you want to run for cover. The wind blows where it chooses, and you hear the sound of it, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. Well, obviously that wind brings me to this morning's gospel. I've always felt a kind of kinship with Nicodemus. In a way, he's like the seekers in my adult formation group in the parish. He approaches Jesus in good faith, but in the dark, at considerable personal risk, in a place that he thinks is safe from exposure, and he does so only to get much more than he'd bargained for. He's like the rich young man in the other story, who had followed the law diligently from his youth, the man who Jesus, according to the gospel writer, the man who Jesus looked upon and loved. He loved him. And yet this rich man nonetheless flees in sorrow and confusion because the demand that Jesus had made on him, that he should sell everything he had, follow him. Well, it was just too much. Just too much. Or Nicodemus is like the Syrian woman who sought after Jesus looking for a cure for her daughter, only to be rebuked as if she were a dog for presuming to cross the dividing line between insider and outsider, Jew and Gentile. And to her credit, she has the gumption to stand up to Jesus. Even the dogs gather the crumbs under the master's table, she says to him. God bless her. Not many of us would have the nerve to do the same. I mean, I wouldn't. Neither did Nicodemus. I mean, to give him credit, he thought he knew what he was doing. I mean, he didn't stumble on the Lord by accident. I mean, he searched him out. He was looking for a rabbi, a teacher. And he knew what he was looking for because he was a rabbi and a teacher himself, a Pharisee, and an unusual Pharisee. I mean, there weren't many Pharisees like him who sat on the ruling council in Jerusalem. I mean, the Pharisees were the reformers. They were the anti-establishment. They were the key players in the struggle against religious bureaucrats and ultra-priests. So no wonder Nicodemus sought out Jesus at night and in secret. I mean, given his public profile, Nicodemus must have feared some danger, public humiliation perhaps, loss of face, loss of office. I have to say, it's kind of the thing that some of my adult candidates for baptism sometimes felt when they had to go public with what they'd planned. And for Nicodemus, it could even have meant loss of liberty if any of his colleagues got wind of the meeting. But the physical risk that Nicodemus ran in arranging to seek out Jesus turns out to be nothing compared to the spiritual risk he takes in actually talking to Jesus face to face. I mean, maybe he thought it would just suffice to acclaim him privately, intimately, to tell him to his face that he recognized in this new rabbi a fellow rabbi. As I say, I mean, he thought he knew what he was doing. And I suppose if we're honest with ourselves, we would have done the same thing. If we had the chance to encounter Jesus in the flesh, imagine yourself encountering Jesus in the flesh, we might arrange to see him with the same kind of caution. I mean, Nicodemus goes to see Jesus as one rabbi to another. I suppose we'd go as one Christian to another, expecting, like Nicodemus, to find in Jesus a wonderfully affirming image of ourselves. And we'd be just as shocked as Nicodemus was. Nicodemus sought out Jesus with what he thought was the right kind of title and the right kind of assumptions and the right kind of approach. He is there with the rabbi he thinks he knows, and what he gets from the Lord is the answer to a question he didn't even know he asked. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born anew, born from above, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Huh? It's an assertion to which Nicodemus just blurts out the kind of question we all want to ask of God in our time of crisis or uncertainty or doubt. In every setback of our lives, the question we all want to ask of God: how can this be? How can this be? Or as Nicodemus says, how can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? Now, these are not stupid questions. I mean, in some ways, I mean, they're empirical questions. And what he gets is a religious answer. And the response he gets is brutal, brutal, overwhelming. Without pity or patience, Jesus says, are you a rabbi? Are you a teacher of Israel? And yet you do not understand these things? It's cruel. Here's this good and courageous man coming out at night at physical risk to assert his solidarity with this new teacher, and he ends up having every credential questioned. He plunges into a nightmare of a rebuke in the darkness that he thought was a safe darkness, a rebuke that strikes home like a thunderbolt, like the winter wind wrecking havoc in the barren trees. Now, if we were honest with ourselves, and honest with God, we might admit that the possibility of suffering a rebuke like that is also our nightmare. It's not safe, you know, this religion stuff. It's not safe. I mean, I don't mean organized religion. I don't mean dwindling membership lists and endless church meetings and eager pledging campaigns and well-laid-out cemeteries. I mean, those are quite safe. Now, that part of religion is quite safe. It's not always economically viable, but it's quite safe. Okay. Now, the part of religion that's not safe, the part of religion that I suspect brings all of us to buildings like this week in and week out, is our hope that we might encounter God. Our hope that we might encounter God. And so it's hard not to sympathize with Nicodemus. We don't always understand. We don't always trust. We're not all that eager to allow ourselves to be seen in the light. That's why when I think of all those who come to places like this seeking an encounter with God, when I thought of all the adults in all those years in New York who were preparing for baptism in the season, I marvel at their courage. I mean, in my old parish, we asked them to make a public avowal of their desire. Then we send them off on this silent retreat. And then we line them up in the church in the dark of Easter Eve with a single burning candle in their hands, waiting for the wind of the Spirit to hit. Those of us who witness such events know in our bones that what happens there is as much about us as it is about them. A reminder of the gap between our own promises and our own actions. A revelation of the darkness that is in us as well as of the light. So, I don't know if you noticed in today's reading, by the time Jesus finishes with him in today's story, I mean, Nicodemus just is blown away. He just vanishes from sight. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. The evangelist has Jesus say this and this and this and this and this and this. It's just overwhelmed with words, and we don't see Nicodemus again. The evangelist goes on to the next chapter. It's as if he's made to disappear, but not quite. He appears twice more in John's gospel, twice more at night. One is in the council just before, after Jesus' arrest, trying to in some ways defend this Jesus to his puzzled colleagues on the council. But the very last time we see him is under cover of darkness, dragging a load of myrrh and aloes that he intends to use to allay the stench of Jesus' corpse in the tomb. 100 pounds of the stuff, we're told, which the experts tell me is about twice as much as you need for the job. When was the last time you dragged 100 pounds of anything? What a load to bear in the darkness. It's as if he wanted to make everything as neat as possible in the midst of such chaos and horror. I mean, for him, perhaps there's a sad but safe finality in this dark burial. It's as if he wants to assure himself that there can be no possibility of any new thing being born from such a grave. No new thing born again, born from above. And in John's gospel, that's the last we see of him, dragging the 100 pounds of myrrh. I need to ask, was that the last that Nicodemus saw of Jesus? Did he join the others on Easter morning to be greeted not with the stench of death, but with the fragrance of myrrh and aloes borne aloft on the morning wind? Did he breathe this new air in shock and wonder, drinking it in, gasping for it like a newborn child? The gospel writer is silent here. Silent, I like to think, because he knew that the way that Nicodemus's story ends is not the point. In the end, the story is about us. Perhaps this is what the Christian life is really about. Facing into that holy wind when it blows, embracing the wind, drinking it in with arms wide open, acknowledging God's own breath in our bodies and in our souls. It's about allowing ourselves to be born again. In spite of our deepest grief, our deepest doubts, our deepest skepticism, to be born again, to be born anew. We come here because we've been asked, can we consent to die to what we are or think we are and rise from that grave to a life of hope and compassion and forgiveness and peacemaking and reconciliation that we can only in our present darkness just begin to imagine, just begin to glimpse. The Spirit of God blows where it chooses. I like to think that by the gospel's end, Nicodemus felt the Spirit's force, felt its restorative life. And my prayer for all of us in this Lent and Easter season is that we might come to feel it as well.